Thank you for tuning in to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM. I'm Mark Dunley.
And I'm Annie. We've got a great program planned for you.
Today, we're going to start off by discussing with Ginny Romer what is going on with the regulation of plastic bags in New York State following the governor and legislature blocking the New York City plastic bag law.
Afterwards, this week's Sustainability Spot features Kevin Carpenter and Laura Cullen, who are rehabbing a foreclosed property in South Troy with an emphasis on energy efficiency.
Next, we'll talk with Sudanese singer Al Sadar, who is performing with her band, the Nubatones, at Proctor's in Schenectady Thursday night.
We finish up with the first installment in the Hudson Mohawk Magazine Physics segment with Dr. David Borton, retired RPI professor and solar boat builder.
But first, some news headlines. The Troy City Council, in a 7-2 vote, rejected Mayor Patrick Madden's proposed 2018 budget after refusing last week to approve a $190 per residential unit tipping fee for garbage. Republicans viewed the fee as a hidden tax hike and complained that it did not commit the city to a volume-based garbage system with financial incentives to reduce the amount of garbage being sent to landfills. The city of Troy presently only recycles 6% of its garbage. The council did approve a budget with a $3 million gap and will leave it to the incoming Democratic majority to figure out how to close it next year.
The power struggle between state and the Senate's mainline Democratic Conference and the 8-member Independent Democratic Conference seemed close to mending yesterday based on statements from Senators Stuart Cousins and Klein. Yet progressive Democrat activists don't seem to place much faith in the deal pushed by Governor Cuomo and continue to mount primary challenges to the IDC. They note that the deal would keep the Republicans in charge of the Senate through the 2018 budget season.
After learning that a New York City hospital had been illegally billing dozens of sexual assault victims for rape kits used to gather evidence, the state attorney general is surveying 10 other hospitals across the state to ensure that other victims are not being charged. State law prohibits charging victims for rape kits, which are used by medical personnel to gather evidence, including DNA samples in sexual assault cases.
Channel 10 is reporting that several women are claiming that Hudson Valley Community College swept their rape cases under the rug. The women came forward after the station reported that a local student says she was raped, but that the college encouraged her not to report her rape to police. A panel of Hudson Valley students and school officials let the alleged rapist resume classes with no punishment. The college has declined on-air interviews, but did say that it complies with state and federal law, informing students they have the right to make a report to college public safety, local law enforcement, and or state police.
So up first is our plastic bag segment. Plastic bags is a big litter, environmental, and taxpayer issue in New York State. Earlier this year, the governor and state legislature blocked a New York City law to deal with plastic bags. We talk with Ginny Romer about what is being done statewide on this issue. We are talking with Ginny Romer, an attorney and founder of PlasticBagsLaw.org and coordinator of the Bag It New York City Coalition. Ginny was also active in California and elsewhere in efforts to restrict the use of plastic bags. Ginny was one of the principal organizers of the law in New York City to restrict access to plastic bags. I should disclose that I was also active in that campaign. That law was blocked, however, by Governor Cuomo and the New York State Legislature. The governor has appointed a task force to develop a proposal for possible statewide action on the issue. Ginny, can you start off with a quick overview of why the use of plastic bags is a problem?
Sure. Thanks for having me, Mark. So the main thing is that plastic bags are seen as an icon of waste and a single-use plastic culture. And that's in large part because they're so visible, because they're thin and aerodynamic. They easily end up as windblown litter and in places where they're not supposed to be, like trees, waterways. So it's something that people really see a lot in their daily lives. So it's an issue that speaks to a lot of people. And the harms that it causes are, like I said, litter. And that means that it's visible in the landscape and that taxpayers have to pay money to have that litter cleaned up, or it persists in the environment. And plastic bags are particularly harmful to aquatic life, generally through breaking down into microplastic pieces, or more specifically to sea turtles. Sea turtles see plastic bags in the water column, think they're jellyfish, and eat them and get stuck in their stomach. And then more, from an urban point of view or a city point of view, plastic bags are really harmful to the recycling system generally, because they tend to clog up recycling machinery. And that really makes it more difficult for cities to recycle more valuable items like bottles and cans. A lot of cities have to shut down their recycling line in order to pick out the plastic film that gets stuck in there. So it causes a lot of different problems.
Could you quickly mention, like in New York City, how much does the city actually end up spending having to put these plastic bags into landfills?
The most recent number I've seen is $12.5 million per year for single-use bags.
Now, the New York City Council spent a number of years developing the legislation in New York City. They got a lot of input from consumers and elected officials and the retail industry. They tried to make some modifications to deal with particular concerns like impact on low-income people. So why did the governor and the New York State Legislature feel the need to block this law, especially when similar laws have been enacted both in other parts of New York State as well as, across the country and, in fact, across the planet?
Well, the American Progressive Bag Alliance, which is the lobbyist group that represents the plastic bag industry in the U.S., was very active in New York. And so one of the main things that they did was lobby at the state legislature before the law had passed the city council. And they were very successful in doing that. And one of the main messaging that they used was a disproportionate impact on low-income communities. And another one that they used was, and this is an industry speaking talking point, and another argument that they used was that bans could be better. And so those are two things that we, as a coalition, really need to address. So the second argument about the industry claiming that bans could be better is just really a red herring, a distraction from going forward with the existing legislation. So we've seen that where bans are in effect, they're really only really effective, most effective, if there is a fee component. In California, there is a plastic bag ban that a lot of people talk about a lot, but most people don't know that that bag ban also includes a 10-cent minimum charge for paper and reusable bags. And so I think the industry spent a lot of time going around to the legislators and saying, this isn't the best law for New York City. And I think gave enough of them pause. And they hired very experienced lobbyists that had a lot of connections and were able to get the moratorium bill really easily through the assembly. And it was a supermajority in both houses. So the governor was really put in a tough position. But I'm just happy to see that he created a task force. And the task force is expected to have a report by the end of the year making recommendations as far as what to do at the state level. But I'm still concerned because that recommendation would still have to get through both houses.
No.
And I can address the second. Oh, go ahead.
Well, I wasn't asked about the issue of the impact upon low-income people, because I know, particularly in New York City, individuals who were making purchases at the store with either SNAP, used to be food stamps, or with WIC, Women, Infants, and Children, you know, were exempted. And so I'm sort of curious about, you know, what evidence is there about the impact upon low-income people and in other, you know, states, cities across the country that have done similar type of efforts, what, you know, studies have shown has been the impact upon low-income people?
So this is a concern, a very genuine concern by a lot of groups, but unfortunately it's really been amplified by the American Progressive Bag Alliance and other groups that they pay to really amplify this issue. But it's something that we've seen in other places, for example, Washington, D.C., where once the law is in effect, it has support across race and income levels, that it's overall seen as a very positive law. And having a fee on a bag is really not meant to have people pay for the bag. It's meant as a disincentive. And so we see that people really bring their own bags a lot more after these laws go into effect. And as you mentioned, the SNAP and WIC transactions are exempted by many of the laws. That's pretty standard. There are only a few laws that don't include that. But when I talk about the disproportionate or potential disproportionate impacts, I really try not to say that first, because really the whole point is to change consumer behavior, to remind people to bring their own bags or to not get a bag if they're just getting an item or two. And so that the bag usage drops a lot. We've seen, depending on the charge per bag, drops between 60 and 90% right away. And so people are using less bags, the first thing I would say. And then second thing is that a lot of the laws, including New York City's law, require the city to do outreach and education about reusable bags. So getting reusable bags into the hands of the people that can't afford them, but don't already have them. And so New York City's law required that, and the city has been doing outreach and education and really tracking where they're doing those bag giveaways. They bought a couple hundred thousand bags to give away, and I'm starting to see them around the city. And then the third thing I would talk about is the exemption for SNAP and WIC transactions. But we want to really focus on, you know, the point isn't to have people pay for a bag, it's to have a change in consumer behavior. And we've seen that these laws are really an effective way to do that. And so, like I said, in Washington, D.C., there was an effect across race and income levels, and there was also a big decrease in litter in communities.
Now, so the governor has appointed, you know, this task force to examine the issue, and I guess to come back with a recommendation. I know the governor has told people he actually intends to make some statement about plastic bags in his State of the State. The last meeting of this task force, I guess the media was allowed in and the public was allowed in. It seemed like, you know, from reports that I've gotten at, you know, several of the people were talking about, I guess, sort of a hybrid system where you ban single-use bags and then you attach fees to the rest of them. But, you know, what are you hoping that the governor does? And, you know, you mentioned just because the governor proposed something doesn't mean that the state legislature is going to go along with it. You know, any sense how the politics in this is going to play out?
Well, I was invited to speak at that roundtable, so I gave testimony and I recommended a ban fee hybrid, or I like to call it a second generation ban. Where there's a ban on the thin plastic under 2.25 milliinches thick is the standard, and then a charge for anything else that's the paper or the thicker plastic that qualifies as reusable. So that's what I was pushing for, and it seems like, you know, that's really where we have good statistics, either for just a fee on all bags or for that hybrid. And I've seen that the governor and the mayor both like to say the word ban a lot, so I think that the governor would maybe lean towards that, but we want to make sure that there's a fee component. And then I also recommended that the fee be allowed to go to a fund for environmental cleanups, because that's another thing that, you know, we really like to push for. But at the city level, we weren't able to do that, we had to have all the money stay with the retailer because it would be arguably unconstitutional because the city doesn't have the power to collect taxes unless they're approved by the state legislature. So we're asking for the governor either to adopt a statewide law that is, like I said, a hybrid or for a fee, and then allow that money to go into a fund. Or if we're not ready to do that yet, if the state legislature is not ready to do that yet, then to adopt enabling legislation that would just allow a city, if they did adopt a law, to have that money go to a fund. And so, you know, this is what we're asking for. As far as whether we can get there with the state legislature, I think that the governor's really, if he wants this to go through, would really have to get behind the law. And like I said, a lot of the talking points against the law in the assembly, which is Democrat controlled, were about low-income communities. Like I said, that's the talking point of the industry, not of the communities themselves for the most part. A lot of environmental justice groups in New York City, including WE Act, are part of this push for plastic bag regulation.
Jenny, we only got about 2 minutes left, so I want to get in two other sort of related questions. So these, you know, progressive bag alliance forces that, you know, sort of killed the New York City bill had been talking previously mm-hmm. about, oh, we should really have a ban. What are they now talking about? And then the second part of the question is, for our listeners who are concerned about the plastic bag issue, you know, in the minute and a half we got left, what can they do to sort of help with this issue?
Well, they can, you know, write to the governor, call the governor's office. I think that right now with it's mostly the task force that's working, but I think tweet about bag laws. If you like Bag It NYC on Facebook, we have updates there. My website's being redone right now, but soon I'll have more information at plasticbaglaws.org specifically about New York City, but there are some updates there. But I think it's just a conversation that New Yorkers should, you know, try to be a part of. The governor really needs to know that this is an issue that New Yorkers do care about in order for him to put some weight behind a bill in the legislature.
Okay, well, we've been talking with Jenny Romer of the Bag It New York City Coalition and PlasticBagsLaw.org. And this has been Mark Dunley for WOOC. Well, that was a segment with Jenny Romer talking about the plastic bags. And this should be heating up right after the new year. I know the governor said he's going to make this a big part of his state of the state. And so I assume we'll be coming back in January, February with more information. So our next segment is on sustainability, and the spot features Kevin Carpenter and Laura Cullen, who are rehabbing a foreclosed property in South Troy with an emphasis on energy efficiency. They spoke with WOOC correspondent Jim Welch.
Welcome, Kevin and Laura.
Hello.
Hi. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the property to begin with?
Sure. Yeah, it was... It's an old house. It is an abused house. It was abandoned, leaking, foreclosed, and we bought it in order to, really one of the reasons to save another house in Troy. We saw a lot of houses being torn down in Troy, and we moved to Troy intentionally and wanted to save another building, keep it from being torn down, and then do a green renovation on it, with the ultimate goal of living in it.
So one of the big things you're doing is spray foam insulation. I'd like to just talk with you about that, or have you tell us what's involved. First of all, preparation.
Sure. So we wanted the house to be very well insulated and air sealed in order to lower the energy needed to heat the house. And because of the condition of the house, it had to be a gut rehab. There wasn't much that we could save on the inside. And so because the walls were open, it enabled us to select spray foam and use it.
So yeah. So when you say you got it, that means you took down any interior wall. So you had just open studs. So you had a service come in and do it. And one of the things they did is they put in all the wiring first before they sprayed it.
Right. So there were a few issues when we opened the walls up. We couldn't save any of the surfaces, the plaster, or any of the other surfaces that were added. So the walls were open, but what we discovered was that there was no open stud cavity to insulate. There was brick nogging in the walls. And with the condition of the house, we had to leave the bricks in. So we ended up having to make the walls a little thicker on the inside by adding framing, and that gave us a cavity to insulate. But before we could insulate, you're correct, they had to install all the wiring that was done by somebody different from the foam company. So we had to run the wiring, have that inspected, and also run refrigeration lines for the future heat pump system that's going to heat the house.
Well, of course, one of the things we should ask you about is the idea of using foam. Obviously, it's a fossil fuel, derived from a fossil fuel. But probably the benefits outweigh the costs, so to speak, environmentally. Would you agree with that?
Certainly. I think on a life cycle basis, the efficiency afforded by the foam in reducing the energy it takes to heat the house over the long term is a clear winner. This particular foam has 15 to 20% natural materials, probably soy based. So it's a little better. We intentionally selected one that uses blowing agents that are low greenhouse gas, so it's pretty green.
I don't suppose you've done a calculation as to the amount of carbon saved versus the amount of carbon that went into the foam in the first place?
I have not.
Okay. And then how about financial cost? How expensive was it? Can you characterize that for us?
We did all of the exterior walls, essentially, and the floor of the attic. And that part of the house was about 1,000 square feet in floor space, so whatever the outside walls add up to. It was about, I think, 800 square feet of wall and about 400 square feet of attic floor. And the overall cost was around $5,000.
Can you talk about the I know there's two kinds of foam insulation. There's the so-called closed cell and the open cell. I understand from a prior conversation you used both. You used closed cell in the wall, open cell in the ceiling. Can you talk about the difference between the two, the different characteristics, and why you use one in one place and the other kind in the other place?
Sure. The closed cell has a higher R value, in this case over 7 per inch. And in order to meet the current energy code, we had to be able to achieve at least R21 in the walls. And to do that without having to make the walls too thick, the closed cell was really the only option that could get us there. The closed cell also acts as a vapor barrier. So we've got air sealing, we have R value, and we have a vapor barrier. And the air sealing is pretty important in terms of, you know, not having a leaky house. So the spray foam, whether it's open or closed, does a good job of sealing up all of the leaks in the walls. The open cell is less R value, also less cost. And we installed that in the attic, and it's not a vapor barrier. I believe it's a vapor retarder. But we were able to meet the very high R value in the code with much less insulation in terms of thickness than if we had used alternatives such as cellulose. And it's also very light. So in this old structure, we were trying to minimize weight in the top end of the house. So really provided a good solution on all those issues.
So another reason that we ended up making that choice with the closed cell insulation was because we didn't know it when we purchased the house, but once we started taking it apart, we realized that there was no exterior sheathing like there is on a modern construction. And that's what gives it its strength. So while we were trying to mull over all these different possibilities, it became pretty clear because of the needs of the house that the options were really limited. And basically the only way we were going to make that R value for the new code and get to live in the house in the near future was to do it from the inside, which is why we ended up having to frame it out. Without the sheathing, the plywood, in other words, on the outside to give it the strength, we needed this the closed cell to add structural stiffness. We had to do it from the inside, and we had to frame the walls. So then the only way to accomplish it was the closed cell because it's the highest R value for the inch. So it worked perfectly.
So now that you have this done, is it more comfortable to work in the finish the interior remodeling work?
Well, yeah, we expect to now be able to work through the winter and be able to keep it comfortable in there. And that was a real driving part of our schedule to get it foamed in before the winter.
You'll still need a heat source, I gather, even though this will help you retain the heat better. Can you talk about what you're using as your heating system?
Sure. So one of the goals is not to combust fossil fuels on site as part of the green renovation. And the high R value in the air sealing of the spray foams will allow us to heat the building with a source that isn't natural gas or another fossil fuel. So what we intend to use are air source heat pumps. They operate by electricity. They can make heat or air conditioning, and we expect that this house will be able to be heated comfortably with that as our source. And our intention is not to reconnect the gas service that's in the house currently.
So it's an all-electric heating system, so I assume you'll want to put solar panels on the roof?
Right. That's in the plans as well. We have a flat garage roof, and we'll add a carport, which will give us about 24 by 24 feet for the PV array.
And that's enough to drive the heat pump and, presumably an electric range and so on?
Well, it's going to be an all-electric house, so heat, cooking, hot water will all be generated by electricity and supplemented by solar. So solar thermal for the hot water, probably solar thermal hot air for space heating as we have the opportunity to do that, and then PV for the electricity. And whatever we need beyond that we'll source by buying green power.
So it's effectively a net zero solution, assuming, again, relying on green power for whatever supplemental energy you need.
Yep, that's correct. And we also do a lot of our transportation by electric vehicle. So we're trying to cover all aspects, the transportation, the space heating, and, of course, the electricity.
So having gone through this experience, do you have any words of encouragement for other people who might be taking on this same sort of a project?
Sure. It's definitely doable. We had to do a bit of research, but we were committed to doing the renovation in as green a way as possible. And we were able to find excellent local contractors. Even, you know, the spray foam company was local. And with just our level of commitment to trying to make it as green as possible, it went very well. And I think it was great. It was a great experience to start with a house that was a complete wreck for little money, and then use the money instead to retrofit it in a green fashion that fit with our lifestyle. So we can feel good about it, and the house is going to be a comfortable place to live for a long time to come, and our carbon footprint is going to end up being very small.
So at the risk of having people turn the radio off next time I come on, I'm going to ask, are you going to invite me to your housewarming party?
Of course.
Thanks very much. All right. We'll see you guys soon.
All right, thanks.
That was Kevin Carpenter and Laura Cullen, who've been renovating a house in South Troy. For those who are just turning in, I'm Annie.
And I'm Mark Dunley. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org.
On Thursday night, Sudanese singer Al-Sara performs with her band, the Nubatones, at Proctor's in Schenectady. We met Al-Sara 2 years ago when she appeared with the Nile Project here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. She spoke to WOOC correspondent Steve Pierce about her background and her music.
Well, I was born in Sudan, in Khartoum, and I moved to the States when I was 11 or 12 via Yemen. I lived in Yemen for a little while, and I sort of ended up in the U.S. It was never really a plan for my family to ever come here. We were not interested in being in America at all. But there was a coup in Sudan in 1989 that my parents were both very politically active, human rights activists and grassroots activists. So we ended up having to leave the country. And then we were in Yemen temporarily waiting for things to calm down in Sudan. And then a brief civil war broke out in Yemen in 1994. And we ended up in the States just randomly, like really overnight. We ended up in the States randomly, like with one bag between us. And then we applied for asylum, became citizens. You know, we applied for asylum. I was illegal for a while. I was in between papers for a while. And so that really taught me how this country deals with foreigners, and how when you come in and no matter how much you assimilate, because it's like I came in young enough that I assimilated quite early on, even if I knew I was from somewhere else. But it was always very obvious from the jump when you come into this world, into America, that America does not perceive itself as the land of immigrants, contrary to popular belief, even though everybody else thinks of it that way.
So you describe this amazing journey. It sounds like a great script for a film. How old were you when you were going to all these countries? Were you old enough to remember the experiences passing through all these amazing cultures?
Oh, absolutely. I was in Yemen from the age of 8 to 11 and a half, 12. I was in Sudan, and I would go back and forth between Yemen and Sudan the whole time. So my connection with Sudan wasn't really severed until I moved to the States. And then while we were applying for our paperwork, we were stuck, you know? And that's the real reality of having paperwork. We were stuck in the system for 9 years, not being able to leave the country, and not really being able to move around or really do anything. So both my parents and I, we all ended up going to school at the same time while we were figuring that out. And so for me, like, that's sort of and the question of where are you from was always there, because I learned English when I came to the States. And so for me, music became kind of like a refuge, a way for me to escape feeling stuck, feeling so alone. And that's how I got into music. And because people had never heard of Sudan when I first moved here, and we didn't, you know, and internet wasn't quite what it was today, people kept trying to be like, well, what does Sudan sound like? And I didn't really know how to describe that, because how do you describe what a country sounds like, you know? And that sort of started me down the path of ethnomusicology and trying to figure out how culture is intertwined in everything we do, from the way we dress to the way we talk to the music we make to the food we eat. And that's sort of, yeah, that's kind of what kicked that pathway open for me. And I started walking down it and then never looked back since.
And you mentioned ethnomusicology. Are you an academic ethnomusicologist or a barefoot ethnomusicologist, somebody who just does it from the heart?
I mean, I studied ethnomusicology, but I abandoned it very, very quickly. I studied music with a concentration in ethnomusicology. So I did 4 years of that, and I even did a field research, and I wrote a thesis, and did all the good jazz. But I quit because I realized I didn't want to be an academic. I didn't want to look at music and musicians from the outside and comment on it. I wanted to make music I wanted to be a musician. I am a musician. I always was. And I just, and for me, but I was really grateful for the tools that ethnomusicology gives you. Because once you have those tools in your hands, you can't unsee the world that way anymore. You know, like I couldn't stop seeing the world as a collection of cultural and anthropological factors that all are distilled in different ways. Which was a really handy thing for me to learn because it explained to me the way a lot of people see my music in the music industry, in the Western music industry especially, kind of prepared me for having to explain to people the differences between traditional and non-traditional, because people often think that if you have a oud and a percussionist on stage with you, that somehow the music is traditional because we don't have any electronics. Whereas to me, I'm like, no, the music is actually not traditional. It's all, most of it is original. We are inspired by traditions. Our first album contained a bunch more traditional tunes, but the whole idea of the band is to be inspired by tradition, because there's no music in the world that is not inspired by traditions. Everything has a tradition, from house music to, you know, to country music, to pop, to old Georgian music, to, you know, to modern Afropop. Everything has roots that it comes from. Nothing is created in a vacuum. So it's important to ask ourselves, why is it that we think of only certain things as having culture and everything else as, quote, not having culture, or being, quote unquote, normal, and everything else, you know, and everything outside of the Western paradigm as being abnormal or needing to be explained through a cultural lens?
Well, it's cool hearing you talk about this from the perspective of a musician and creator, and with an academic tinge. Your discussion about ethnomusicology reminds me of Danny from the Debo Band, who has this amazing grasp of Ethiopian music and was a second away from a PhD from Harvard, I think, and decided, who needs it? I'm going to play music. You guys should start a band together.
Yeah, you know what it is? I think Danny and I are kindred spirits in that sense, because we're all diasporic children. We're people on a bridge where we can see on both sides of the bridge, really. And there's not, it's not just me. It's me, Danny, Sinkane, Odyssey, a lot of other young people that people think of as being a part of the Western medium that are actually immigrant kids, adding different influences and sounds to the American scape. And the American scape's always taking that in. So for me, I'm not the only one, because for us, I think we were musicians who wanted to do non-Western music. And at first we were presented with ethnomusicology and academia as being the only option, you know, if you didn't want to be traditional, you know, because a lot of us are creating our own work. And then I think for us, eventually, like I know for me, after a second, I was like, no, I actually don't want to just look at it. I want to contribute to this canon of work. I want to be a part of this canon of work, because I'm just a musician. I just thought that if I didn't want to sing in English, I needed to give an explanation for why.
Sure. So when we were talking about Danny and Ethiopian music, it reminds me that I at least had some conception of what Ethiopian music was from albums like from Astor Weke and a few people who made it into Western fringe pop culture. But I don't know anything about what Sudanese music is, with the cultural traditions there, what contributed to the popularized forms of it. What can you tell us about Sudanese music from that perspective?
Well, Sudanese music is really diverse. That's really the inherent part of it. And I think because Sudan was really closed off from the world for a really long time due to civil wars and sanctions and whatnot, a lot of people didn't get exposed to that canon of work. And Sudan is interesting to me because it's really at the crossroads between, you know, the Arab presence in Africa and the sub-Saharan presence in Africa. We have both influences equally strong in it. And as a result, our classical canon of work, our quote-unquote orchestra sound that had its golden era in the 60s and 70s, was an interesting hodgepodge of both. I almost think of it as like Sudanese classical, our attempt at making a classical sound, you know? Big orchestra, giant compositions. And that body of work was hugely consumed in East Africa. Between Sudan and Ethiopia, there's always been a big exchange of music. And a lot of songs in Ethiopia are actually of Sudanese origin. Because the pathway in that area was always much more flexible. and the connections were much more flexible. But its presence in the States is a rather new one for Sudanese music. But I think with the digitizing of the world, the lifting of sanctions, hopefully that comes in more and more. I mean, and there's been people that made it into the Western labels like Abdelgader Salim, Rasha, Sheikh Ad-Din. There was a couple of other compilations that also came out in the past that had some Sudanese music in it. But Sudan was always a little, I think, too far and too poor for people to have really heard of. And we did not have our giant wave of migration until much, much later than other parts of East Africa. You know, Ethiopia, a lot of people, there was mass migrations that started happening in the 70s. In Sudan, it really didn't start for us until the late 80s, 90s. And so that means that there's finally a generation that grew up in the diaspora enough to be able to communicate with both sides.
There was a guy here in the New York Capital Region who did a Arabic music show on the local college station. And it was just such an eye-opener for me, ear-opener. It's just this amazing ocean of cultural history and incredible sounds, you know, that really were totally foreign to me. It was difficult to get access to them at the time. And now the world is, you know, wide open in terms of being able to do research in that area. It's an incredible cultural tradition, and I think Americans would do well to soak in it a little bit more, which they're going to be able to do on Thursday night at Proctor's. Now, when I saw you at Global Fest most recently, a artist showcase mega concert in New York City every January, you were one of about, I don't know, a dozen performers being presented to not just the public, but also to booking agents around the country. So that puts you in a pantheon of greats already. You're part of the short list of folks who are being presented for touring opportunities. And I was just struck by the whole act. You had, you know, a really great band, and you have, you know, of course, you're such a wonderful singer, but also all the way down to the costumes and everything. You had the whole thing worked out. How did you come to the look and the sound that you're touring with now?
You know, I think New York has a huge part of how I came to the look and the sound that we have. I've always been a very visual person in general. I've always loved visual arts, and my grandmother was a seamstress and a clothing designer. My uncle's a painter, so we come from a visually aware family in a way. But for me, I feel like this band to me is New York City. You know, I met all these musicians in New York working on different projects from different places. New York City for me always felt like a place where it is so normal to be from somewhere else, which is why I've always felt so at home here. And it was one of the few places where I felt like I can make music not in English and have it just be considered, like have people just come to consume it for the art of it, not because it needed to be explained. And so for me, I felt like I can grow, I can put together something that visually has, because to me, I'm like, we're a band, we're artists. I'm looking at other artists. I look at Grace Jones just as much as I look at Biko Dude, just as much as I look at Beyonce, just as much as I look at Ash Al Falatiya in Sudan. To me, they're all equal bodies of inspiration. I've never really seen a separation in them to me. Like, it's all part of the same circle of music and sound. And New York is the city a swag. If you don't have swag, what's going to set you apart, right? So for me, coming in New York, my look, the band, and all of that is the gift of my home, New York, to me.
Great. Well, we're looking forward to seeing and hearing that gift close to home, saving the trip to New York City, at least for the first taste. As we check out the band at Proctor's on Thursday night. Thanks so much for joining us via the magic of Skype, Alsara, and we're looking forward to seeing you on Thursday.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Of the Nubatones, speaking with WOOC correspondent Steve Pierce. She's performing Thursday evening at Proctor's in Schenectady.
Carl Sagan, who passed away in 1996, is best known for the documentary-style television show Cosmos, A Personal Voyage. Broadcast in 1980, the series examined complex scientific concepts. The goal was to make science accessible, something your average American could understand, with topics ranging from the history of astronomical observation to the exploration of space-time dimensions. Tonight, we have the first installment in the Hudson Mohawk Magazine Physics segment with someone who is walking in the footsteps of Dr. Sagan and Dr. Tyson. WOOC correspondent Megan Marone caught up with Dr. David Borton, retired RPI professor and solar boat builder, and the host of WOOC's transmitter, to hear about how rocket science can be brought down to Earth.
Okay, we're here with David Borton, retired RPI professor of engineering and physics aficionado. So, David, what are we talking about today?
The simple topic is rocket science, but we'll make it a little simpler than what that sounds like.
So, what do you mean by rocket science?
Well, if you want to go to the moon and back, you need to know a little bit of physics. In addition to that, you need to know some mathematics. And the mathematics is a lot harder than the physics, so we'll start with the physics. Tell me about the kinds of sports you know of that use balls.
Well, lacrosse uses a type of ball, and baseball, and football, and basketball.
If you think about it, there's a long history of using balls. The Incas had a game where they ran a ball through a hole, and balls have been in all kinds of sporting events. So the one I want to talk about today is basketball. So let's talk about that.
And why do you want to talk about basketball?
Because I know you know about basketball.
that's a good joke.
All right, so tell me what you think a three-point shot is in basketball.
Okay, well, strolling down the foggy lanes of memory, I believe that a three-point shot is when the player stands at the foul line.
Well, there is a line that the player has to be outside of, yes.
There's a line on that court.
Yeah.
They stand there and then shoot to get 3 points.
Okay, well, it's actually a curved line, and it's not the single line for a foul shot, which is 1 point, but it's a curved line you stand outside of, and you get 3 points when you get the shot. What does that look like? If you have ever seen a person shoot a basketball, tell me what you've seen. Well, you've done it, right?
I have done it.
So tell me what you did.
Prayed.
Good.
Dribbled the basketball, tried to tighten my core, bent my knees, took a shot.
Okay, so take a shot. You have taken the shot. I'm going to say you pushed on the basketball, right?
Yes.
Okay, then what happened?
I tried to use a technique my brothers showed me, tried to push the basketball up in the air in a curved direction towards the hoop.
Perfect. Perfect. And after you let go of the basketball, what did the basketball do?
Flew in a curve towards the hoop and bounced far away.
Okay. So now we're going to come to Newton's laws. This is very basic physics, and you just described a bunch of it. So if you have something that is not moving, what does it tend to do?
Not have energy.
Not move anymore. A body at rest tends to stay at rest, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, you said the basketball was moving. What does the basketball tend to do?
Continue in motion.
You just recited one of Newton's laws of physics.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, so that's one of Newton's laws. A body at rest tends to stay at rest, and a body in motion tends to stay in motion. Okay, so now then, let's talk about what you did. What did you do? How did you get the ball to go toward the hoop?
Pushed it towards the air and the hoop.
So the ball has some mass, right? And you put a force on there. You put an unbalanced force on there. And if there's an unbalanced force, Newton's law says that there's going to be an acceleration that's proportional to the force. You might have heard of mass equals, force equals mass times acceleration. Have you ever heard of that?
Yes.
Oh, good. See, there you go. Another one of Newton's laws.
So the unbalanced force causes acceleration, and this is a universal law in physics.
That's correct. You just figured it out.
Always applicable.
Yes. And that's one of the nice things about physics. Have you ever broken the law?
Many times.
All right. Well, those aren't laws. Those are rules. Okay, there's a rule that says, you know, go 30 in town, okay? Now, you can break that rule. The laws of physics you cannot break.
Hmm.
No one breaks the laws of physics. Cool, huh?
Very cool. So whether you're talking about an adolescent's arms pushing a basketball up in the air towards the net or tugboat pushing another boat,
nobody breaks the law.
Yeah. Applicable, right.
Right. So let's go back to the basketball. How long does it take to go from your hand to the hoop?
I'm not sure.
About a heartbeat. Okay, how long's a heartbeat?
Split second?
No.
Boom, boom. 1 second.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay.
So a second is about a heartbeat. Okay, now about how long did you push on the ball?
A second.
Well, less than that. More like a third of a heartbeat. Okay, that's the part where the heart is contracting, you know, just a fraction of it.
For our listeners, why is it important to know? Let's take the first law, Newton's first law. A body at rest tends to stay at rest. A body in motion tends to stay in motion. So why is it important to know that?
Well, suppose you're driving in a car.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a brick wall in front of you. What happens?
To slam on the brakes.
Okay, because the body in motion tends to stay in motion, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't do something about it, you're going to have a major wreck. Now, there are other kinds of shooting. Can you think of another kind of shooting?
Well, I mentioned lacrosse before, where you have something, the ball is projected out of a net. Or you think about a bullet in a gun.
Good.
And you shoot the gun to shoot the bullet.
Right. And what kind of science did we say we were going to talk about?
Rocket science.
Okay. So all of these things, it applies. It applies whether it's, throwing a cup of coffee at somebody across the table. These laws apply. Wouldn't it be good to know them?
Yes.
So we have this ball, and it's going toward the hoop. Can you talk about the motion in two different dimensions?
You have the dimension of space. It's flying through space, right?
Yeah, it's going from here to here.
Right.
But at the same time, it's going
Perpendicular or up vertically towards the hoop, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. And then what does it do?
Bounces off.
No.
Nothing but net.
Besides going up, it has to go
Down.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Now tell me about things going down.
They seem to gain speed as they fall. Okay. There's an increased speed to that.
That's Newton's law. Remember we said there's an acceleration proportional to the mass, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we have this acceleration. As something falls, gravity causes the acceleration. And so when you push this ball, besides pushing it toward the hoop, you're also pushing it against gravity up in the air, and then gravity brings it back down again faster and faster with acceleration.
Okay, but that speed also being determined by the mass of the object that's falling downward.
No, that was my mistake.
Okay.
The acceleration is a constant on Earth, and it's 32 feet per second per second. So in the first second, it starts to go from zero speed to 32 feet per second. In the second second, it goes from 32 feet per second to 64 feet per second.
Regardless of the mass, that acceleration takes place.
Right. Now, of course, if you drop a feather, the feather has more air resistance than anything else. And so it actually is slowed down by air resistance. But that's because the force of the air resistance slows it down. Remember the law that says that there's a force acting on something, it changes its motion.
You know, what's interesting is that I like how you delineated for our listenership the difference between the rules that society makes up in terms of legality and things that are legal or not legal, and then these physics laws as being actual laws. And to me, that seems like a pretty important distinction for our listenership.
Well, yes. And if you think about it, can people from different religions play basketball?
Of course.
How about different countries?
Of course.
Yeah. These laws are universal laws. They apply throughout the universe and actually across, you know, time and space. So that's pretty cool. If you know a little bit of physics, you know it not only here, but you know it wherever you go.
Well, as you and I have talked about, I am not a trained person in science as you are. I have taught poetry and been an English teacher, but the overlap there and what you were just talking about is people's consciousness and how they actually think about things. So it's interesting. We would have a more humanist world, it seems, a more binded world if we maybe thought about these universal laws of physics that apply to all of us and the rest of the cosmos.
Well, I like that. That's why we're talking about it, and the fact that you know physics. We just found out that you know Newton's three laws of motion.
So how did you get into physics, and why did you get a PhD?
Well, okay, let's start with the first one. This morning I was cutting wood, splitting wood for fires. That's physical work. When I was a teenager, I was pulling stumps and moving rocks and that kind of thing, and that's physical work. And you learn quickly that there are some rocks you can't move, okay? But then you find out that if you take a lever, you can move that rock. You've done that, something like that?
Probably. Mm-hmm.
All right, well, many people can relate to that. And if you can relate to that, that's physics. Because by using a lever, you use a small force, something that you can apply, and you move it over a distance, and that moves the big rock, something you can't move without the lever, over another shorter distance. And so you can actually get this big rock out of the ground, even if the rock weighs more than you do.
Hmm. So maybe that's how Stonehenge was constructed, using levers.
Yeah, levers and rollers and things like that. Of course, because people can't move that much without some sort of physics help. So it becomes pretty obvious that you need to think about physics if you're doing physical work.
So our last question for this segment is, how did you get into solar energy? Because you've been on the Hudson Mohawk magazine before talking about the construction of your beautiful boat, the Solar Sal. And how does that relate to physics? And is this also probably a to be continued?
Oh, yeah, definitely to be continued. But a while back, there was an energy crisis, and I could not buy oil or gasoline in this area. And can you imagine anything more un-American than not being able to buy gasoline?
Not really.
Okay, so if you know something about physics and you look around, you can look at all the other kinds of energy that are available. And it turns out that solar energy is the one that works all over the planet, and it's really the best one for our society.
Well, thank you so much for being on. And we're looking forward to your upcoming populist science segments on WOOC.
Thank you.
That was physics scholar and solar boat builder David Borton, with his first segment in an ongoing physics series on the Hudson Mohawk magazine.
Well, that concludes our show. Once again, we hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk magazine. I'm Mark Dunley.
And I'm Annie. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news.
And speaking of tomorrow, we have a bunch of exciting guests for tomorrow's show. We'll have our usual youth bucket. We have a segment with a boxer from Troy who is, I believe, fighting for the world championship in a few months. We'll have our woman entrepreneurial segment. And we also have an interview with Osman Khan, who's going to be here at the sanctuary on Friday. And she has just released a report or an article about the United States military airstrike in Iraq. And in fact, unfortunately, that far more civilians are being killed there than we led to believe. But to learn more about this program and how you can support the Sanctuary Independent Media, feel free to visit our website at mediasanctuary.org.
If you'd like more information on how you can participate in the production of this program or have suggestions on stories you'd like to hear, please email us at info@mediasanctuary.org.